Let's turn to Psalm 77. While you are turning, I'd like to ask, what attribute of God has been a mainstay for you in the last week or the last month, maybe the last year? What attribute of God has kept you focused and stable? Just go ahead and shout that out. Faithfulness. Great is thy faithfulness. Lamentations chapter 3. Lover of my soul. Perfect love. Steadfast. He never changes. Aren't you glad for that? Power. Omnipotent. Patience. He restores. What is it? Protector. Well, thank the Lord for that. His mercy. Mercy is anew every morning. Forgiveness. You're glad for the forgiveness of God. In fact, the most godlike thing that a human can do is forgive. That's the most godlike thing we can do, because forgiveness is prompted out of a spirit-filled heart of love. One more.
Steadfast.
The same yesterday, same today, and same forever. It is a joy to see Carolyn Price. Been so faithful for so many years, and thank the Lord for the strength that wisdom God has given her through all of the pressures and trials, and then the Curtis family, who so faithfully has focused on serving the Lord, and of course the boys' home, while my bodyguards up here keep them up in the front. But we're so thankful for the ministry that God gives. You know, sometimes we get lost in the chase. And we need to get to higher ground to see where home base is. Because when we get going through life sometimes, you get to a point where you wonder, have I believed the wrong thing? Is this God, who is a God of love, really a God of love? If he is, why does he let things happen the way he lets things happen? And our mind begins to spiral down into depression. We have a handout for you called the Symptoms and Solutions to Depression. I remember reading some years ago, Graham Scroggie, a great theologian, went to visit Benjamin Parsons, who had been a faithful, godly pastor for many years. And as Scroggie went to see Benjamin Parsons in his room where he was dying, a nurse came in and said, "Mr. Parsons, can I get you a pillow to make you more comfortable?" And I like the answer he gave. He said, "My heart is resting on three pillows. God's infinite power, the pillow of God's infinite love, and the pillow of God's infinite wisdom. I am resting well, thank you." What a way to go into the presence of the Lord. Waiting and resting. You know what that comes out of? A proper view of God. And I think when we look in Psalm 77 today, we're going to learn of Asaph. Asaph was one who never hesitated to question God. Ever get to a point in life where you question God and you feel so guilty over questioning him? Well, you read Psalm 73 and Psalm 77, Asaph had no such qualms about going to God and saying, "God, what are you doing? Can't you see what is happening?" And during the last several years of our ministry, Charlene and I have traveled We begun to observe that numbers of people sitting in church, nicely dressed, appearing to have no problems, are sitting with bitterness and very, very subtle anger. And oftentimes that anger is directed against God. Because they look at someone else and they look at that circumstance, what they perceive to be another family, never having an issue, never having a problem. And they sit in bitterness, questioning, why does God allow these things to happen? And the sweet song that used to be in their soul as they came to meet with the people of God has now gone away and has been replaced with a somberness, with a questioning, and with a cry in their hearts, I wish that I could really believe what I once believed when I was in such joy when I came to meet with the people of God. Many of you are very familiar with Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the great, considered to be probably one of the greatest ever expositors, started as a teenager actually. And Spurgeon was going through his commentary on the Psalms as he was writing his commentary. And he pointed out that the past that he had known and the present were two different worlds. Spurgeon was saying, the past that I've known is not the same as the present that I am now experiencing. And it's helpful for us to know as we try to struggle through steps of life and through phases of life, it is helpful for us to know that great men of the past, in fact, if you were to take Bible examples, not just men of history, but Bible examples of, in Hebrews 11 would be a great chapter for you to meditate on. And the honesty with which they express their feelings, it's helpful for us sometimes. Now, but for example, consider the experience of the greatest Bible expositor of all time, Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Now, James Montgomery Boyce, in his commentary on the Psalms, in doing his research, had come across Spurgeon's exposition of the Psalms. And he comments on the struggle shared by Spurgeon, and I read this in the Treasury of David myself. And Charles Haddon Spurgeon wrote in his commentaries on the Psalms between 1865 and 1885, he was in 20 years writing these commentaries on Psalms. In 20 years, he experienced poor health, which continued to his death. Neuralgia, gout left him with swollen, red, painful limbs, so he often could not walk or even write. Debilitating bouts of depression and headaches added to these and other ills led to frightful bouts of depression, which left him nearly in despair. He left London for the warmer weather of southern France, where he made his departure into his eternal home. On Psalm 77, Spurgeon said, some of us know what it is both physically and spiritually to be compelled to use these words, referring to the words of Asaph. No respite has been offered by the silence of the night. Our bed has been a rack to us. Our body has been in torment, our soul in anguish. Alas, this author knows the deep glens and the lonely caves of soul depression. And my spirit knows full well your awful gloom, speaking of Asaph. That's the great Charles Haddon Spurgeon, leaving for southern France for warmer climate and goes into the Lord's presence. But what a treasure he left us in his commentary on Psalms called The Treasury of David. And I want us to look into Psalm 77 this morning and see some of the symptoms of depression that would show up in our lives. Psalm 77 in verse 1, I cried unto God with my voice, even unto God with my voice, and he gave ear unto me. In the day of my trouble I sought the Lord, my soul ran in the night and ceased not. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Selah. Thou beholdest mine eyes waking, I am so troubled I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old and the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I commune with mine own heart, and my spirit made diligent search. So that's the introduction. That is the testimony of Asaph. One God chose to write the psalm. First of all, we notice uncomforted soul as a symptom of his depression. He said, the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord in verse 2. My soul ran in the night. In other words, it seemed like an unceasing running. And ceased not, my soul refused to be comforted. So first of all, we see an uncomforted soul. Someone would come and you have gone to try to bring a word of encouragement to someone who is in depths of despair. No matter what word you express, there's no comfort that comes because the soul refused comfort. Because of the wrestling with God, because of the questioning of what God was doing. And refused comfort. Have you ever been there? Number two, we see an overwhelmed spirit. Look in verse 3. I remembered God. So his mind is going back. I remember how God was. And was troubled. I complained. And my spirit was overwhelmed. He said, I look back at what was. And what a great parallel we have for Psalm 42 and 43. Remembering the days of sweet times of fellowship and the sweet memories that were long past. He said, I looked and my spirit was overwhelmed. Have you ever come to a time in your life and said, God, I can't take any more of this. I just can't take any more. Everything seems so overwhelming. You wonder why young people take their own lives. You wonder why some people come to a point in life, why go on? Some people come to such a point of despair and their spirit is so overwhelmed. They cannot be comforted. They cannot see the light for the darkness. And then number three, troubled sleep. Look in verse 4. Thou beholdest mine eyes waking. In other words, go to bed, but you don't sleep. Ever been there? Get in bed, you lay down, you lay on your right side, you lay on your left side, you lay on your back, you lay on your stomach and teeter. Some of us. No sleep. You can't wait for the daylight to break. Coffee isn't helping. Because you can't sleep. I like what David said in early in the Psalms, chapter 2 or 3. He said, I will both lay me down and sleep. For the Lord only makes me to be in comfort. Troubled sleep. Sleeping pills don't take away the overwhelmed spirit. Sleeping aids do not remove the uncomforted soul. It may give you a little bit of rest, but you wake up in a cloud. You're still not seeing the mercy and the goodness of God. Then we see silenced speech. Verse 4, I am so troubled I cannot speak. You see the phone ring. You see a name come up on the screen. I cannot speak. My lips are silent. Remember, I was reading this week in my personal read through the Bible on Hannah in the first chapter of 1 Samuel. And Hannah was so troubled in her soul, so burdened in her spirit, that only her lips would move. In fact, Eli thought she had been drinking. He said, "Don't be such an evil woman. This is not for you to be drinking." And Hannah, finally, when she could communicate, "Eli, I'm not drinking. My soul is troubled." And there was silent speech. All she could do was pour out her heart to God, laying there on the floor. And then we find in verse 6, diligent search was made. I called to remembrance my song in the night. I communed with mine own heart, and my spirit made diligent search. I think of the prophet Habakkuk. Habakkuk in his spirit and his soul was making diligent search. God, how can you use the Assyrians, a much more wicked people than we are, to bring judgment upon us? And Habakkuk was searching. And then he said in chapter 2 of Habakkuk, in verse 1, he said, "Now I will go and wait when I am rebuked. What will God say to me?" Because Habakkuk was challenging God. And God says, Habakkuk, it's going to get worse. But I will deal with the arrogant in my way and in my time. But the just shall live by his faith. Boy, that's a focus. And God answered the diligent search of Habakkuk by saying, Habakkuk, you let me take charge. I will deal with the wicked in my way. I will deal with the wicked in my time. And you see five reversals in Habakkuk chapter 2, where the diligent search of the soul of Habakkuk was answered by the revival in chapter 3 of Habakkuk. In the darkest times, revival comes when people of God cry out unto him. So we make the statement, I can't take anymore. Where do we turn? What do we do? Then the psalmist goes into 6 rhetorical questions. And this is a pivot point in this chapter. It's just like a linchpin. You have this, and then you have your pin, and that thing pivots. And what happened is there was a pivot from here up here, but in the middle of that pivot, that linchpin came in with these 5 rhetorical questions. Will the Lord cast us off forever? He says in verse 7. In other words, God, have you forever cast us away? Will he be favorable no more? There in verse 7, God, will you no longer be favorable to us? Is his mercy clean gone in verse 8? In other words, we saw the attribute of God and his mercy, as you called out, the mercy of God. And is his mercy clean gone? No more mercy? Does his promise fail forevermore? In verse 7, in other words, God, is it worthless for us to go to your word and claim your promises? Because it seemed like all the promises we claim, we don't see any result. And then has God forgotten to be gracious? Verse 9. Has he forgotten to be gracious? God, you're a God of grace. You're a God of mercy. You're a God of favor. Have you forgotten that part of your character? And hath he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Verse 9. Hath he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Selah. In other words, think on that. And we're about to see a Selah turn into a sigh that in turn turns into a time of rejoicing when we see, yes, stop and think of this. And what was going on in the life of Asaph at this point? Because when you read Psalm 73, and you see the testimony of Asaph in Psalm 73. He was questioning God, why are the wicked in prosperity and the righteous are suffering? In other words, the wicked are wicked. We know the wicked are wicked, and we know they're in nothing but prosperity. They have this and they have that. They're getting more of this and they're getting more of that. And then he said, I became envious of the wicked. This is Asaph. And then he made the statement, I've made myself righteous in vain. In other words, there comes a time when Satan will hammer your mind and say, you made the wrong decision. Look at the world. Look at their prosperity. They're wicked and they never get judged. But then Asaph said in Psalm 73, until I went into the sanctuary of God and I considered their end. See, what happened is he pivoted up to an eternal perspective and realized that, yes, they are on slippery places headed for hell. And as he was saying this, he said, what I'm going through now is nothing compared to what they will have for eternity. And he got the perspective. There was a lady, it was in one of the meetings, and she had an alcoholic husband, very abusive. And people at the church were saying, you know, why do you put up with him? She said, well, you know, since I became a believer, I know what is in store for me. This little temporary suffering right now is nothing compared to what, unless he believes the message of the gospel and becomes a believer, is nothing compared. She said, I'm trying to do whatever he can, whatever I can to make him comfortable because this is the best he will ever know. Because when he dies and slips into eternity, he'll never know another ounce of mercy. And she said, I'm going to put up with it as much as I can to make him comfortable because this is the best he will ever, ever know. You know, isn't it good to know anything that we go through now? I wake up in the morning, I think if I'm not in hell, that's more than I deserve. That's a good start. I'm not in hell. Amen. Let's get at it. Because what I deserve is the eternal damnation. But yet, thank God for his mercy. And what happened? Now we get to the solution as we close. What's the solution to depression? Now we see the pivot point in the first portion of this chapter, verses 1 through 6. There were 18 times, I, me, my. 18 times everything was about me. That's really where depression is. When it's all about me. I'm never encouraged. No word can help me. No, nothing will help my overwhelmed spirit. Nothing will cure my troubled sleep because I have been wrong. Instead of looking and pivoting up to him. And so after his rhetorical questions, and obviously, no, he hasn't cast us off. No, he hasn't chosen not to be favorable. No, he hasn't taken his mercy clean away from us. No, his promises are not failed. No, his grace has not stopped. No, he hasn't shut up his tender mercies. Now suddenly the psalmist turns upward. No more I, me, my. Is the last chapters, 13 through 20, there were 21 mentions of God or God's attributes and not one single mention of I, me, my. There's the beginning of solution. It's not about me. It's about how we glorify him in our lives. And you look in verse 11. Verse 10, I said in mine infirmities, I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. Now his memory goes back again. And I will remember the works of God. Number one, how do we begin to overcome depression and discouragement and an overwhelmed spirit? Start meditating on the wonderful works of God. We are fellowshipping this morning were on the coffee pot there with one of our former friends, and we were reviewing the Monday morning Works of God testimonies. And how our hearts were lifted for 40 minutes as we were reviewing the wonderful works of God that took place in the last 7 days. You'd be very helped by keeping a Works of God journal. You know, when you get into such a place where you can't see light for the darkness, and the light you thought you saw coming through the tunnel was a diesel coming to run you over. And you go back and focus on the works of God. A good place to begin is the work of the finished work of Christ on the cross. Realize, according to 2 Corinthians chapter 4, this is a very brief time. We get an eternal gaze, not a temporal gaze. Think of how God has worked in your life. You got out of bed this morning. You had two good legs. Oh, for the most part, some of us who are getting older don't have many good parts left. I keep replacing parts. I told one lady, I said, if Napa doesn't run out of parts, I can keep going for a while. When I had my hip put in, I asked the doctor if he could put a Zert in there to pump grease. They don't know what Zerts are even. That medical training is shot. You don't know what a Zert is. But think of the works of God. You have eyes. My brother Stan was shot deer hunting accident several years ago, senior year in high school. Paralyzed the rest of his life, died at age 49. And make a long story short, after his wife died with cancer, I became his, taking care of the legal work that had to be done, paperwork for the state and so on, when he got to a point where he could not function. And I would go up to visit him in the hospital. He would have to go in the hospital in Pontiac, Michigan. Sometimes there's a medical wing, and then there was a mental wing. And I would go up there to visit him. He would have to go in and get his blood built because of the osteomyelitis in his back. They had to get sugar and oxygen and blow that in, and then he would be in there sometimes for a week or 2 weeks maybe. And one of the times he was there, his wife called me and said, Les, I have to go see a doctor. I'm not feeling well. And don't tell Stan because he'll be worried. Don't even mention it to him. Long story short, she went in to see the doctor. He said, we need to do exploratory on you. And they opened her up. She died on the operating table. Wanda's sister called me and said, Les, you're going to have to go and tell Stan Wanda died. I walk into Stan's room at this hospital and I said, Stan, I have bad news. He said, yeah, I know, Wanda died. I said, how did you know that? He said, that's the worst news you could ever tell me today. I said, well, that's true. Well, I'm not going to get more into that, but one of the men in the hospital said, let me take you through somewhere. And he took me over to another wing and he took me through a ward where you open the, unlock the door, enter that ward, and there's nothing but moaning and screaming. Bodies in bed, children born twisted, and all they can do is moan and scream, and there are others who are in the different states. And he said, this is one wing of misery. I get back in my car to drive back to Roseville. And I think, what a dope I am. Get so upset about the dumbest things. Worried that this, and how am I going to do this pressure, and how am I going to get that done, and how am, and I'm thinking, I was able to walk to my car and had a car to drive. I become so self-focused Well, remember the wonders of God, it says in verse 11. I will remember thy wonders of old. And if you took time to go back and review Old Testament, the wonders of God. That's enough to make a Presbyterian take a running fit. I mean, you stop to think that the wonders of all God from our creation. The man who dug the balloons, we were talking back there and said, yeah, he takes balloons and makes animals. God just spoke and out of dust we came. You talk about a wonder of God. The wonder of creation. I still heat with wood. I have another new one after 18 years, another new burner with a 200-gallon tank, and that thing needs to be fed early in the morning when we're home. 5:30 in the morning, go out there, and the air gets a little nip in it up here once in a while in January. And we had about 2 weeks of solid nips. I think it was in December, early January. But when it's 20 below or 15 below, the sky is like sparkling like diamonds. And I'd go and load my stove, and then I'd close the door, and then I would turn and look up, and the sky is like sparkling diamonds. And I just throw my arms in the air, hallelujah. Because the one who spoke this into existence said, Father, forgive them. He cried, it is finished. The work of salvation is done. Should we not lift up in praise and adoration to him the wonders of God? And then he talked about the worship of God. Look in verse 13. Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? The worship of God. Lifting up our hearts in praise and adoration to him. And verse 13 talks about the worship that went in the sanctuary. But then in verse 19, we think of in the sea. Thy way in the sea and thy path is the great waters. Thy footsteps are not known. Nothing more wondrous than an ocean that is tossing. You want to feel helpless. Go and stand on the shore when those waves are coming in, and it's just an overwhelming crashing. And then verse 13, the ways of God. You know, you question the ways of God. God, how do you work? What are your ways? When God talked to Moses in Exodus 33, and Moses was called of God to take the Israelites. Now remember, he's 80 years old when God calls Moses to take the people from Egypt to Canaan. They didn't want to leave Egypt and they didn't want to go to Canaan. Now here's Moses with this assignment. And Moses said, I can't. How did God answer that? I am. I am that I... Don't say I can to the I am that I am. Moses said, I can't speak. And I think Moses' stuttering problem started when God told him to pick that snake up by the tail. I think his speech was fine until then. Don't look too deeply into that, however. But you know what God... Moses said, God, show me your ways. If you want me to do, show me your ways. And then he said, God, show me your glory. In other words, I want to know your ways, but then I also want to know your presence. Show me your glory. And Moses went with that group, and it was no small project. In fact, it said there were 600,000 fighting men, which meant there were probably at least 600,000 fighting women, and then maybe 3 million screaming kids. That was a large group. And pardon my play on words, but they gave Moses such a headache, God gave him 2 tablets. I said, pardon my play on words. Only man in history broke all Ten Commandments at the same time. Then consider the shepherding of God. Look in verse 20. Thou leddest thy people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. The shepherding. Have you ever meditated on Psalm 23? You stop to think Psalm 22, we see the good shepherd who laid down his life. Psalm 23, the great shepherd who provides. And Psalm 24, the chief shepherd who is coming for us. Psalm 22, 23, and 24 are a picture of three pictures of our shepherd. The good one laying down his life, the great shepherd guiding us, and the chief shepherd who is tending and coming for us. And he said, you led us like a flock. We're sheep, but yet we're under the care of our all-caring, all-loving God. No wonder David said in Psalm 46:10, be still and know that I am God. The hard thing is to be still. We feel like we've got to just jump and get at it. And sometimes God said, no, be still. Be still. We go from tempest to peace, and we go from knowing the wrath of which God is capable to his love, which is never ending. In Job 42 and verse 12, the latter end, that should be E-N-D, not A-N-D, the latter end is better than the first. No matter what Job went through, the latter end was better than the first. No matter what you're going through, you know what is coming if you know the Lord as Savior. Paul said this, light affliction, which is but for a moment, works for us a far more an eternal weight of glory. This light affliction, when you study what Paul went through, how he could call it light, only would be by the empowerment and the goodness and the grace of God. Let's bow our heads together. You know, while our heads are bowed and hearts are bowed before the Lord, I'm just going to invite you this morning to say, Lord, thank you for loving me. Maybe as the pianist plays quietly, just come and slip to our knees here on the front and say, God, thank you for loving me. Forgive me for complaining. Forgive me, Father, for questioning you. And say, God, I acknowledge that it's been about me. But God, I want to glorify you. And in the last song that was sung and the special that was sung was all dealing with God shaping us into the image of his Son. May God give us words to strengthen us. As the pianist begins to play, let's stand quietly to our feet with our heads bowed. And I open the opportunity for you to just come here and slip to your knees and say, God, forgive me for being a questioner of your goodness when I know that you never change, your mercies never fail, your promises never fail. You are good. You are God. And thank you for even having a chapter in your word that one of your writers was honest enough to share his feelings, to which I could relate. God, just thank you for loving me. We're not going to sing. We'll just have the piano play quietly, and others perhaps will want to come and just get before the Lord. Say, Lord, thank you. Maybe go to your knees right there where you are. Say, God, thank you for loving me perfectly. Thank you for caring. Say, acknowledge your goodness to me. You play through one more time. Father, thank you for the word. Thank you for the Spirit of God who lives within believers to give the power, the resurrection power, to love you and obey you and glorify you. May our hearts be lifted to you as we consider your wonders and your ways and your works, that our hearts would be lifted up in worship to you. We thank you for your faithfulness. In Jesus' name, amen.